Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Hello, and thank you for coming. Now, on the day of the Flixwise podcast, I'm your host and drunken wedding floozy, Lady P. No relation to Master P. And joining me today is raging hothead with a heart of gold, Mr. Gabe Haggard.
Someday, and this day may never come, I will call upon you to do me a service.
And making another appearance on the show is returning hero and our one shot at respectability, my brother, Mr. Gary Lampert.
May this podcast be a masculine podcast.
That's right, it's a family affair.
Woo!
And speaking of families, today's sight and sound entry, the 21st movie on the critics poll, is Francis Ford Coppola's The Godfather. Listeners, you know what that means. It means there will be some pretty terrible Brando impressions coming your way in the very near future. But we promise to take the cotton balls out of our mouths long enough to discuss the film and talk about why it's supposedly one of the greatest pieces of classic American cinema. And not to give anything away, but we're going to follow up our Godfather analysis with a discussion about overrated movies. We're going to talk about how we determine if a movie is overrated, and then we're each going to slaughter a couple of sacred cows and talk about our individual choices for most overrated movie. Things could get ugly, feelings might get hurt. Should be good listening. Then, hopefully, we'll come around to the good side again. We'll reset our cheese and leave you with our touches of zen or our final notes of positivity. Are we ready?
Let's do this.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Anyone know where I can grab some cannolis? For our first topic, we're going to talk about Francis Ford Coppola's The Godfather. Since you, dear listener, are enjoying our podcast, I think it's safe to assume that you have access to the internet and therefore are at least somewhat familiar with The Godfather series. But just in case, here's some critical stuff you should know about the film. It was released in 1972 to critical and commercial acclaim. The Godfather is an epic saga about a wealthy and powerful Italian-American family. How did this family become so wealthy and powerful? Well, they don't discuss their business. And I'm a lady, so I definitely need to be kept in the dark. But suffice to say, they aren't selling patio furniture.
Yeah, it's olive oil, isn't it?
Yeah. The Godfather is a gangster movie. Some might even say it is the gangster movie. It stars Marlon Brando as the family patriarch, Vito Corleone, Al Pacino as his youngest son, Michael Corleone, as well as a slew of other great American acting talents, including James Caan, Robert Duvall, and, of course, Diane Keaton.
And Adrian.
Lest we forget. I think that's about all that we need to say for the warm-up. If you haven't seen the movie already, go watch it. The film is widely reputed to be one of the greatest movies ever made. As I mentioned, it's the 21st greatest movie of all time, according to the Sight and Sound poll. Its standing in the cultural pantheon is widely accepted by critics and everyday moviegoers alike. But what does our little panel think about the movie? Let's find out, shall we? So, Gabe, you like The Godfather?
Yeah, I think this movie's really good. I really enjoy it. I think it's awesome.
Okay. Gary, how about you?
I agree. I love The Godfather. I think 21 is too low.
Okay. Well, hold your horses, Gary. We're getting there. So for me, the way I feel about this movie is the way a lot of people feel about Citizen Kane, which is that I appreciate the movie and I understand that it's really well made. But I don't understand its high standing amongst critics and people. People seem to love this movie much more than I do. And I'm wondering, I guess since you guys love it so much, I'm wondering maybe you guys can tell me why, what it is about it that really draws you in. Obviously, I can see that it's a three-hour movie and it clips right along. You know, it's very engrossing. It's beautiful to look at. But I also have some very, very serious issues with the film. And one of those issues is, for a gangster movie, it's not very subversive. It seems to want to uphold the basic, you know, patriarchal American values. It seems like it wants to reinforce those values. And so therein lies my biggest problem with the film. But so let's get into some of the themes. Some have said that this movie is less about gangsters than it is about a portrait of family. Let's talk about the central role of the family in the film. Gabe, did you have any thoughts?
I think I would agree with that. The movie is more about the family, mm-hmm. Than, you know, like just, you know, a gangster film. The family is clearly central to the story, and it's the family that kind of gets the ball rolling, in the sense that you'd say the movie, I think the movie is about the corruption, basically, of Michael Corleone. Mm-hmm. And it's by means of the family that occurs. And so it's like the family and this sort of warped or dying sense of family that starts Michael down this path.
Yeah. Well, Gare, what do you think about the central role of family? What is the role of family in this film?
Yeah, so to the extent that this is an accurate portrayal of life in America or anywhere, it really gives you a sense of Sicilian culture, mm-hmm. and the Sicilian family, which it's very patriarchal, male-dominated, and I have an appreciation for movies where it's just not just armchair psychology or something like that. It's showing you something. You get this portrait of Sicilian culture. Now, part of this is not quite accurate, so the extent to which the Sicilian family life is tied up with the mob, my understanding is prior to the book and then the movie, the guys who were actively involved with organized crime were not such great family guys. But
shocking.
But isn't that portrayed in the film? That this, while hanging on to some sort of idealistic family life, it is pretty clear that these men are terrible, are poor family men.
With the exception of the Godfather.
In a way, but that's sort of, a dying breed. This ideal, this family life ideal, is being portrayed as not good.
So let me just for clarification's sake, the family as represented by the Corleones with Vito at the head, that is the ideal American family, and then through the course of the film, we see the disintegration of the American family. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Well,
American family, but the disintegration of the family.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how strongly what Vito is doing, or Vito's family, how high a pedestal that's actually being put on.
Mm-hmm.
Because while, you know, would appear to be sort of idyllic,
mm-mm.
How Vito runs his family, it is direct. Vito's actions are directly responsible for what his children have become.
Mm-hmm.
I think,
yeah,
you know, and it's odd when towards the end, one of the last scenes between Vito and Michael, Vito has this very interesting sort of paradox to his character. He says, you know, I didn't want this for you.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted you to be spared this. And then he says, I don't apologize for what I've done.
Yeah.
But I wanted it to be different for you. And so it's this weird thing. It was like, look, buddy, you are admitting that you are horrible. Mm-hmm. You know, that you've done horrible things. And you're not apologizing for that.
Right. I think that is a sort of a central disconnect in the movie where we are, I think, meant to romanticize Vito as this brilliant leader, a great leader and a great family man, a compassionate man. But at the same time, you're right, his business is atrocious. So there is this mm-hmm. sort of disconnect in when you watch it. You're at once sort of rooting for him, and he seems sympathetic, but his progeny turn out to be kind of monstrous. But we don't find that out until later.
Well, and that's the thing that I would say. I think the film is portraying that it is a dichotomy in the character, but I think the film is highlighting that.
Hmm.
The film is not saying, hey, look how great Vito is.
Mm-hmm. Really? That's I guess part of my problem is that I do feel he is romanticized. He's Marlon Brando. He's larger than life. I think people want to be Vito.
Right. And I'd even say, so this is part of another subject of the film. It's kind of just about the general generational gap that's developing. And in some ways, it's sort of Coppola's it's their critique of where business is going. Where, you know, Brando, he won't get into... Vito, he won't get into narcotics. He, you know, we just supply harmless vices where, you know, it's because the church won't allow it, so we'll do this. But Michael is a businessman, and since Godfather 2 is later on this list, we'll try to avoid talking about that too much. But, you know, there's this gap between what Michael's willing to do for the business and what Vito's willing to do. And so there's definitely this portrayal that Vito has standards. He's very reluctant and hates killing, and this doesn't go on to the kids.
Right.
With the exception of Tom, who's not really the kid.
Right.
Tom is the clear-headed one.
Right, right.
Not Sicilian.
Yeah,
so.
I know. So let me ask you, do you think this film romanticizes the mafia?
I don't think it does.
Okay.
Because by the end, when... you see the last shot when you see Kay's face and the door closes. Michael is a complete and out monster.
Mm-hmm.
Michael is a terrible person. And I think that is portrayed. And all throughout, like, I think showcasing sort of this, again, this paradox between in the life of, you know, of a gangster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the time when Michael goes to Sicily, and you know they go to the mattresses, you know, and they have that little sweet montage of like photos of all these guys, all these Sicilian guys, you know, hanging out, and it kind of looks cool, you know, it kind of looks like fun,
mm-hmm.
you know, they're all big group, spaghetti, but even that is juxtaposed with these gruesome images
mm-hmm.
of death and destruction, and they don't pull any punches. And so I think the film is showcasing the problem with the gangster lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, hey, yeah, it's cool and family and blah, 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 but it's terrible.
Mm-hmm. Gary, how about you? Do you think it romanticizes the mafia?
I'd say a bit. So the changes we see in Michael, I think the film takes an attitude that this is a sad, it's very sad. We didn't want to see this. You could see the reaction of Vito, when he finds out that Michael was the one who shot them.
A single tear.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. you know, it's very sad. But the film portrays, especially the way Vito runs it, he's just a very successful businessman in this small cutout of business life, you
mm-hmm.
know, organized crime.
Yeah.
You even hear the line, I don't like killing. Blood's a big business expense.
Mm-hmm. right.
But I think that's almost, in a sick way, almost played for laughs. That's like that guy's an idiot.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, oh, really? Oh, yeah.
But I don't Blood think is- it's played. I think they're being very serious. I think that the film is presenting the gangster life as just another facet of America, as just another family business.
Right.
I think that is the way the film is presented.
To the point where Vito, you know, he's almost what we have in mind as someone who's like the perfect... If it weren't for, you know, the fact that he's supplying these criminal activities and occasionally having people killed, he's like the perfect patriarch. He takes care of his family. He leaves, you know, because he's in a dangerous business, he leaves the wife and all the women out of the business. Make sure they don't get their hands dirty. One of his sons, he tries to get out of that business and try to give him a different life.
But don't you see the end as being an inevitability based precisely on Vito?
I mean, whether it's inevitable or not, I think that the lifestyle is romanticized. I think we see the results of this business. We see that giant house. We see the lovely family. We see the food. We see the cars. I mean, this it's clearly shown to be profitable. And I think that people watch the movie and the Vito character is seen to be sort of an aspirational character. I think people watch the film and sort of, it's sort of a fantasy for people right. that they could have that amount of power and that existence. It seems right. appealing well, to people.
I think it's that's exactly what the film is not doing, because the film is showing how that power corrupts and how that power is a horrible thing
mm-hmm.
by means of the character of Michael.
Mm-hmm.
It's showing like how corrupt and how awful. By the end of the film, he is despicable.
Mm-hmm.
He's shut the door on his wife, and he's murdered the heads of the five other families, mm-hmm. and along with some prostitutes. And you know, he's a terrible person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the film is showing that, is saying like, look, you know, this was a good boy.
Mm-hmm.
That came into this life and was and became thoroughly corrupted by it.
Mm.
Yeah, but I mean, so we don't, I agree that's how we're supposed to view it at the end, but I don't think we blame Vito for that. I think we view it as kind of inevitable. So you see, I mean, he's got a knack for it. You see it, the initial part where he's staying out of it, and he, along with a baker, or I don't remember, they're standing outside the hospital. And they could get killed, and he has his hand in his pocket, and he has to light the cigarette, and he sees his hands are completely stable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he's
yeah.
got a knack for this thing.
Right. Yeah, I think Michael was a sociopath from the beginning. I don't think it was Vito through any kind of familial encouragement that he ended up
no,
in the position
family
that
is why he does that.
Right.
The family
well, he
is
had
exactly.
access to it. Yeah, it's the family business. But
yeah, the family, his sense of duty to the family is precisely why Michael gets involved in it in the first place.
What, right. Well,
so it is the family's fault in a way. The family's fault is Vito's fault because, you know, it's Vito that sets him up.
It's funny. I just had a very different reaction. Like, I see the film, and I see people's reaction to the film, and I think that it really does make the lifestyle very appealing. And despite all the murdering, I don't think the murdering and the violence registers with people when they watch the movie. I think people see that it's all just part of the game, you know? It's part of...
Well, but I mean, some of it... So when he kills his brother-in-law, that's just cold murder. I mean,
right.
he's... I don't think people identify with that.
No, I think they do. Like, that dude's got it coming. I think so.
I don't know. I think...
He can't let that dude live. I mean, in the rules of this... In the rules of morality in this universe, I don't think he can let that guy live.
Well, that... I mean, and that's disgusting.
Well, yeah, but within the rules of this universe, that is absolutely how it works. The film creates its own moral code.
No, I don't think the film creates its own moral code. I mean, I think that's the juxtaposing of the baptism with all the murder, is that it's showing a ceremony that is, you know, does have to do, you know, with purity and a small child and innocence and all that, things that are, you know, good and beautiful and innocent and perfect,
mm-hmm.
Juxtaposed with horror,
mm-hmm.
with abject horror. I think that's what the film, that's the moral code of the film.
Okay. Gary, would you agree with that?
Yeah, though I agree with you that, I think in hip-hop culture and gangster culture, like Vito is he's the guy,
he's the godfather. I mean, I don't think there's any question that the hero of the movie is Vito.
Right. I mean, it's hard to watch this if you've seen the second one. It's hard to watch the first one
right.
the same way again.
Right, exactly. I think a lot of what we're saying about Michael becoming a monster is just the residual emotions from seeing the second one. After seeing the first one, you get this, there's this stirring, this sense of dread, but it's totally confirmed in the second one. And now when I watch the first movie, I can't help but think about the second movie and what a true monster he becomes in that one. I mean, I think that many movies, many films, many television shows deal in a universe of moral ambiguity, and I think this movie absolutely does. And I think
absolutely not.
Okay.
I don't think it does at all.
Okay.
I mean that is shown to be despicable, I think, what Michael does. Mm-hmm. Like all the murder and the whatnot and the lying to his wife, the completely, objectification. Like, look at his whole, courtship with Kay. He treats her terribly.
Yeah.
And that is bad. And okay. that is something that...
See, but I just don't feel that the film portrays these things as bad. And I thank you for giving me the perfect transition to my main issue with this film. And that is that I feel like this film upholds the values of the 1940s patriarchy and the Vito character being emblematic of the ideal American man, that stoic American man, that cowboy, that gangster, not even gangster. He's more of a cowboy figure. He's more of a John Wayne figure. And in this universe...
Well, we don't need to drag the Duke into this.
So sorry. Don't mean to take the Duke's name in vain. But I think that... it's no mistake that this film was set in just immediately following the World War II. A time, an era that many people point to as being the greatest time in American history. And we have this, not only is Michael, he's a war hero, and Vito is I feel an idealized patriarch, takes care of the family, is a loving father, he's a reasonable man, he's intelligent, versus what we see from other characters, like, say, Sonny, who is sort of hysterical, is shown as a hothead. He's emotional. We see Connie, the sister, Talia Shire. She's emotional. She's a hothead, whereas an emotion typically associated with femininity, whether that's fair or not, we can debate.
Wait, are you saying even, like, Sonny's hotheadedness?
Yeah, exactly. It's seen as more a feminine trait. I think that the emotional reserve of Michael and Vito is the American idealized portrait of masculinity. And I don't think it's an accident that the women are totally sidelined in the film. Besides Connie, obviously, who her role is to become hysterical. That is her exclusively her only. That is her only role. And Kay. It's never really explained what her attraction is to Michael. She's just kind of there to be the maternal figure. So, I mean, in films, subsequent films, women have been given slightly bigger parts. And indeed, Kay's role in the second one, I think, is further developed. And I think that's one of the reasons that I personally prefer the second one. But I honestly think that this film, I think that's sort of the appeal of the film, is that it does present this idealized American male in this very glamorous setting. And I think the cinematography really supports this. I think the whole film is like bathed in this nostalgic glow. So and that's not something that I respond to very well, personally.
Right. I mean, so part of what you're complaining about is the women lack agency, right?
Sure.
So they're, we don't have any reason to, we don't know why they make the decisions they make. I take it for granted. So this is a 3-hour movie.
Yes.
If we had fully developed females where, like, we go into their thoughts and all that, you just can't fit all that much in the movie.
We fit a lot. We found some time to show boobs. There was time enough for that. You make time to develop your characters.
Well,
I don't buy that for a second. You can develop. You can have fully developed characters in a 90-minute movie. There are a lot of characters. None of the female characters are well developed.
Right,
at
because the business world does not revolve around the women. Now, you may complain about that and say, isn't this terrible that it's a male-dominated society?
But I think that is what the film is... One of the things that the film is showing as so terrible is that this setup, this dichotomy of family, of business, of husband and wife relations is terrible.
Okay.
Yes, you could argue that they could have done it differently. They could have done it in a different way, had Kay be a more developed person.
Mm-hmm.
But the character
have
that Kay...
Have Kay have any kind of objection at all, have anything to say at
it,
all.
But doesn't that make it worse that Michael is taking advantage of this woman?
No.
Why?
No, it doesn't make it worse. I mean,
why was Kay with Michael?
Right. Why was Kay with Michael? That's a really good question.
Right. So that's what I'm saying. We don't have time to.
I think we do. I think we absolutely have time.
What do you think would be the answer? The answer, I think, would be that Kay is a very dysfunctional person.
She has no reason. You're just extrapolating from nothing. I mean, we don't know anything.
Why do you think that she's with Michael?
That's a really good question. I have no idea. That's one of the faults of the film. I have no idea. And that would have gone a long way in developing Michael's character had we seen Kay and Michael interact as a couple. I mean,
That's the whole point. He doesn't interact with her as a couple.
We're supposed to see the trajectory, right? To see Michael go from innocent to this monster. We never see innocent Michael, really. We see very, very brief.
At the very beginning, he's coming back from the war. He's a war hero. Mm-hmm. Coming back from the war, he says, "This is what my family does. This is not what I do." Mm-hmm. And he is trying to keep himself separated from the family because the family business is being gangsters and killing people, mm-hmm. and Michael wants no part of that.
Mm-hmm. So to some extent, you're just for that to work, and it gets into how you watch movies and whether you want it to work. You have to just assume. When we see them at the beginning, she's already fallen for him.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I guess.
Well, and you see that too when he's in the family portrait and he brings her in.
That's the one moment we get. That's Michael's one redeeming moment in this movie that we have no reason to believe.
Michael becomes a terrible person.
But that's what I'm saying. Michael is always a terrible person. That's my argument. I think the disconnect between me and Gabe and I are. I guess arguing about is whether the film, you don't think that the film romanticizes this lifestyle. I think it does. So I think the question it becomes whether the filmmaker is portraying this as, it's not even so important what Francis Ford Coppola was trying to do, but ultimately what comes across on screen to you as you watch it. You see despicable people doing despicable things. I see a
slow descent into despair. I see a good man becoming awful.
Yeah, I see the American dream on screen in sort of a... It's subverting the notion of the American dream where... in order to get ahead in this world, people do awful things and awful things happen and people profit from it.
And I think the film is saying that's not good.
I think it's saying it's not passing any judgment whatsoever, and it's letting Marlon Brando have really awesome lines, and it's letting Michael seem really cool. I do think it romanticizes.
But I mean, it's a larger point here. So even let's suppose you're right and that's what's coming across, that would mean you're disagreeing with the moral statements it's making, mm-hmm. or how it's, I mean, so can you not enjoy a movie even though you disagree with?
It's not so much the moral statement that it's not so much that I have a problem romanticizing the mafia, which I do, for the record.
As do I.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, it's more
the reinforcement of the gender politics that I have a bigger problem with, or with the family dynamic that I have a problem with, conflating the mafia with family and traditional values.
Right, even if you have a problem with this portrayal of family and how it's supposed to work here or there.
I mean, I guess
you could say it's still a very powerful portrayal.
Sure, huh? Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, the film is obviously a classic, and I think it's extremely well put together. But as I said, I don't think that the story, there's so much story here that I feel like we have to extrapolate a lot about the characters, especially the female characters, and I think that is a shortcoming of the film. And that's sort of where this might have been better as sort of a longer form story as told maybe through a miniseries, but I guess ultimately they go on to make even more movies. So, but I do think that the condensing of time doesn't serve the movie all that well.
Right.
Beautiful as it is.
Well, it does take place over, 10 years or something.
It's a long time. It's a lot to condense. There's a lot of story packed in there, and what he chose to portray is bothersome to me, personally. I don't know. So, but you're right that... it's an interesting question. Can you appreciate a portrayal of a moral universe that you find objectionable? It's a tough one. I mean, I enjoy watching Goodfellas. I enjoy...
Well, Goodfellas takes a decisively negative attitude towards
right,
all this.
Right, exactly, yeah. but at the same time, still sort of glamorizing it. But it's not bathed in that nostalgic glow that The Godfather is. I feel like The Godfather is decidedly, the way it's shot is so, it's just so beautiful that I think that adds to the romanticism. The chiaroscuro lighting, it looks like an Italian romantic, it looks like a Rubens painting or something, you know.
so, yeah, and I just think that all adds to the gravity and the ultimate, you know, point that the whole film is making.
A couple more questions. Let's talk about the film's influence. I know I mentioned Goodfellas. I think we can kind of draw a line of in cinema history. There's before The Godfather and there's after The Godfather. Let's maybe talk about a couple of examples of how it influenced future film.
Well, a side note is it not only influenced films, it influenced gangsters. So they started becoming more family men who thought it would be really cool to be like Vito afterwards. Yeah. they used to be kind of squalid people, but...
now they're upstanding.
Yeah. So this won Best Picture in 1972. In 71, we have the French Connection, which is...
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe the credit really should go to the French Connection.
Yeah. Where it's also kind of suave, smooth-talking gangsters who are driving the action. I don't know. I feel like, to some extent, the influence strictly on gangster movies, it hasn't continued in that way just because... The image of The Godfather so dominates our vision of what the gangster looks like that you can't redo this to some extent. Mm. So we get Pacino again in Scarface, and he, if you've seen Scarface, he's nothing like...
Exactly. He's more of a Sonny in that one, right?
Right. So I feel like...
More feminine, yes.
more feminine, yes. So I feel like to some extent it's just... dominates our mind of what the mafia is like, but they don't try to imitate it as much as you'd think. They try to go the opposite way now, just because you can't replicate it. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I try to come up with things where it's like they're taking this archetype, and you know, it's not as many as you think.
So. Does it rightfully overshadow all the rest of the gangster movies? Basically, what I'm asking you is, does this movie, does The Godfather deserve to be the 21st greatest movie of all time, which is where the Sight and Sound critics have put it?
I would say, based on the films that came before, that I would put it even higher on the list. And that is due to its narrative nature. That I think it's more a film, it encapsulates more the goal of filmmaking than some previous films. What I would use as an example would be, say, Man with a Movie Camera. Mm-hmm. Now, I love Man with a Movie Camera, but I would place something, a film like Godfather, higher than Man with a Movie Camera. Sort of in a similar way that I would say, I love Bach. Mm-hmm. But I think that Mozart is better music.
Okay.
Because it's more, you know, he has more tools at his disposal. And so you could argue that without Bach, you would never have Mozart. And that might be, and that's fair. So you say without a film like Man with a Movie Camera, you might never have The Godfather. And that's very true. But on a list of greatest of all time, I would like to see movies like The Godfather a little higher than films like Man with a Movie Camera.
All right. Well, Gary, you've already revealed your answer. Would you have anything else to add?
You actually had two questions. Like, how does it compare to earlier gangster movies?
Yeah.
I don't know how many I've seen. But there's almost no compare. They're completely different style movies. Mm-hmm. Godfather was way better than any of the earlier Cagney or Robinson movies I've seen. Bogart also as well. But I feel like we almost take it for granted how great this movie is. Like, even your objections are kind of like, Well, it's so well made and so beautiful to look at that, you know, I find it troubling.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, now part of it, I've made this remark in the past, though the listeners will not have heard the remark, but, you know, part of the appeal of the actors in the movie where you look at the cast and it's just staggering, and but to some extent that's like, oh, James Caan, he's a great actor. He was in The Godfather.
Yeah. right.
You know, these guys are partially famous because they're in it, but everyone, like, gives this amazing, well, I mean, Keaton and Shire, I mean, they don't have as much to do.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the people in the family, they just give amazing performances. I think it's, of Brando's performances, I think there's no other movie, and I mentioned in our inaugural podcast that On the Waterfront is one of my five favorite movies.
Yeah.
There's no other movie where the Brandoisms, like the random, you know, touching of his face or the weird pause or something, works quite as well. It's a really great movie, and I feel like people don't appreciate it as much because it's just everyone knows, oh yeah, The Godfather.
All right, so 20, but 21, is that
I think it should be higher. Okay. I feel like these Sight and Sound snobs, they're sticking it to these Hollywood movies.
Okay. Well, I personally think that 21 is actually a pretty good place for this movie because I do think that there's no that I mean obviously it's a very very significant film in Hollywood history and movie history. However, I don't think it's as interesting as many of the other films on the list. I think it's ultimately a very simple story. Very, as Gabe has said, very well told, and it's beautiful, but ultimately I don't know that there's that much substance, and the message of the film I find very troubling, personally. So, I'm gonna go with 21. 21 seems like a fair spot. Given my feelings about The Godfather, I thought it would be appropriate if, for our second topic, we talked about movies that we feel are overrated. A huge reason I started this podcast was because I wanted to determine for myself whether the movies that the critics have deemed canon-worthy are actually deserving of the praise and the attention they receive. That's why for each movie that we discuss, I always ask, is it worthy of its spot on the Sight and Sound list? But today I want to delve deeper into what we mean when we say that something is overrated. And then each of us are going to offer up some examples of films that need to be taken down a few notches. So let's just talk generally. What do you think, how and why do films become overrated, Gabe?
One area in which films can become overrated is when they're about a volatile topic or some significant event. And so people will sort of jump on board just because of it's about something significant. And so before watching the film to see if it's a good film, they'll, you know, lavish praises upon it just because it's daring to tackle some issue.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that can often be a cause.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. Do you have an example of a film?
I think this one's going to be. We may have to end up scratching.
Oh
this
dear!
Because
is it going to upset too many people?
I don't know, and I haven't thought about this out too much. But
okay.
I think a film that I would say is overrated because of the subject matter that it tackles would be the film Crash.
Okay.
and it kind of tackles the issue of racism.
Mm-hmm.
And but why I think it's overrated is because I don't think it gets us anywhere.
Yeah.
In the sense that I don't think it pushes forward the narrative, if you will, in greater, you know, human understanding of racism.
Yeah.
You know,
I
think that people will kind of like just, oh, it's so great.
Yeah.
It's such a great movie. And I think that was because it was tackling a very real issue.
Right,
you know,
yeah.
A very important issue. But I don't think it got us anywhere.
Yeah. No, so. I think a lot of people, when it initially came out, it got the Oprah machine behind it. And there was this giant push to get it the Oscar. And it ended up taking it over Brokeback Mountain, which I think is a much better film. And I think there's been actually a very a strong backlash to that film. I think most people agree that that movie is actually pretty atrocious. That's not a good movie at all. I'm not sure. I don't know. I guess there are people out there that really still like that movie. Right. But I don't think those people have rewatched it. Well, because
I mean, I don't like the movie. I mean, it could be just because it got the... I think part of it wasn't just like it addressed the subject. It addressed it in a way that was... It seemed to be daring... in the way it framed it, so it was everyone's kind of a hypocrite, right. And you know, at the end, it's you know, those guys who were more outrageously racist, they end up being sort of the hero, and
right, and, yeah, and, isn't that cute? How clever,
right? There's irony abounds, right. And at the time I saw it, I thought to myself, you know, there's some things to grab here or there from it, you know. There's somewhat of an engaging story with the daughter and how she ends up being alive and all that, and you know, it pulls on your heartstrings. And some scenes are done well. I'd have to think about it. I think it's my least favorite Best Picture winner I've seen.
Yeah,
it's been a long time since I've seen Titanic. I must admit.
Oh, that's a great movie.
My heart will go on.
That's right.
On and on and on.
That's
it's
right.
A very long film.
Right. It's yeah. So, it'd be, nothing comes to mind approaching it. But it's certainly true. And you know, this is I think something come back. There's something about social psychology where things kind of build up where. You know, they talk about this, and it gets people talking.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say 12 Years a Slave, and then we were going to have to maybe edit that out, because that's a controversial opinion.
I haven't seen that.
Okay, yeah. But I think generally speaking, people agree that Crash was, like, a pretty not great movie. But there is this hype that builds up, yeah. And then when people see the movie and they go, wait a minute, this is not worthy of this critical praise, then there's this, like... backlash. People get angry at the movie. I think people are angry at Crash.
It could be.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't been following the pulse of the Crash, but it's just like I remember watching it and then being like,
not so good.
I mean, I feel like so just to defend the movie, I feel like if it was just any other movie and someone said, "Hey, you should watch that," you might be more open, receptive to some parts of it.
That's why I would call it an overrated film.
Right.
Like it doesn't deserve,
right?
At least at the time, it doesn't deserve the craze that was around it.
Right. Right.
You know, whereas if it just a it's Saturday night film movie, you'd be like, oh, there's some compelling things. It ultimately didn't really get me very far, but there were some interesting things.
Right.
I know it's different stories all put together, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
I think part of when I think of overrated movies, I don't think of movies that are bad. I think of movies that are just overpraised. So like I think part of being overrated also means that there is going to be something to latch on to. But just those certain people have latched onto those things and taken it too far. Right. I would argue Crash is a terrible movie, actually. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's very much to latch onto in that film. I don't think it's interesting to look at. I don't think it's shot well. I think it's incredibly condescending. I think it's racist. I mean, I didn't mean for this to turn into a rag on Crash thing,
right.
But yeah.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
I mean. So what's an example of a film that you
I
find
think is
overrated?
For me, a movie that people seem to really adore, and I can see that there are good parts about it, I just don't love it, is 12 Angry Men. I do not love that movie at all. I have a lot of problems with how the Henry Fonda character is depicted as being very, very virtuous. And I think it also is part of my problem with the play, the original play. So the original subcontent I didn't respond to in high school, and I've since seen the movie, and I find it very, very troubling, people's seeming reactions to the movie. I think it's shot well. I think Sidney Lumet, who directed it, did a good job keeping it moving, keeping it going. But I don't think Henry Fonda's performance is that good. I know. I'm ragging on Henry Fonda here. I feel like I'm taking a big step out on the ledge, and I feel like you guys could push me over at any moment. Do you guys agree, or?
It's been so long.
It's been a long time, yeah.
I mean, I, like you, have trouble with... So I've never served on a jury, but I know this is not the way you're supposed to... You're not supposed to be their lawyer.
No! Everything he... All the investigating he does of the trial, it's horrifying. It's so scary. But he goes and purchases the exact same knife. Oh, how convenient. Give me a break. Come on. Like, that. There's something about that movie that makes me really angry. And I know I should be... Like, it's about a poor boy who's on trial and probably didn't do it. Or the film would have us believe that he didn't do it. Even though it's clear to me that he totally did. And we're supposed to cheer when he gets off. I know. I'm a terrible, horrible racist, whatever.
Right, but I mean... it's... I don't know. I mean, you're supposed to respond to it in the same way you respond to Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. You know, the one man making the argument where it seems like, you know, he has no chance.
Right. And overcoming insurmountable odds. And yeah. But that being said, like, I have no qualms about the way the movie was directed. So it's not...
All right. I mean, I think people admire that they're able to film this whole movie basically in this one room.
Right. Yeah.
Keep the action going.
Yeah. And, so nothing against Sidney Lumet, who is a fine director. But Gary, do you have an example?
Yeah. I don't know how to say this. It will be controversial, but I just don't understand Pearl Harbor.
Okay.
Oh, that is...
That Gary, how could you?
Is there like a society out there that thinks that's a good movie?
Well, you know, they decided to give Michael Bay more movies after that.
Right.
I'm sorry. I, you know, I'm an honest man, and I just have to say what I think. Yeah. I didn't connect.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Was that on the Sight and Sound list? Just barely. Barely. Yeah. Do you have any other films, perhaps, that you think are
so about? This is, you know, more of that social psychology where you get the hype machine and... So the makers of this had been consistently excellent. It's not a bad movie, but particularly it was hyped by my generation. Toy Story 3.
Ah, okay.
People were hyping that as the best Pixar movie.
Wow,
and it was
okay.
Like sure to bring you to tears and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole dynamic where I'm supposed to get really weepy about him giving up his toys.
Yeah.
They had its moments, but it just didn't...
Okay.
I don't know. I can't relate to that. I'm like, this is silly.
Ah, you heartless monster.
Yeah.
Proving once again that you are the idealized stoic American male.
That's right. Yeah.
No crying. There's no crying in baseball. There's no crying in the movie.
That's right. Well, but, I mean, this is on the heels of Up, which was a delightful movie. And that really pulls on your heartstrings.
Ooh, tell me you cried at that one, though. Come on.
I mean, I got a little verklempt.
Oh,
but...
Oh, God. Gabe, did you cry at Up?
I don't cry.
Ever?
No, I cry, but not in films.
Okay. Yeah, no, so. I agree that it's certainly not the best Pixar movie, and it's probably overrated because I think you're right that it
pulled on the heartstrings of the millennials who had seen the previous two movies.
Well, that's the thing. Like it's standing on the shoulders of giants, you know, in a sense that it's really like it's a nice bow on top of that. The package of Toy Story.
Right. I understand that, but I actually liked the first two Toy Story movies better than that. I felt it was too self-consciously nostalgic about the previous two movies.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good example of a movie that might be considered overrated. Yeah. So we can also mention performances that we think are overrated, or actors or directors, generally speaking, that we feel are overrated.
Well, I mean, the Oscar-winning thing is kind of a cue. So, Nicolas Cage in Leaving Las Vegas, I don't know, it might be a good performance, but what an unpleasant movie that is. I'll bring in another Nicolas Cage movie because I know at least Roger Ebert liked it. I think he got pretty good praise, but The Weatherman?
Oh, yeah, I think people hate that movie.
Oh, do?
Yeah.
I know at least some people.
Yeah.
Like that.
But that's
was one of the most excruciating...
Well, okay, but isn't any film with Nick Cage pretty excruciating?
Con Air is a masterpiece.
Okay. Con Air, sorry, I apologize. Con Air is a masterpiece. The Rock.
Face Off.
That's true.
These are all great.
It's just a grab bag.
I guess this is sort of a controversial one for me. I think Daniel Day-Lewis is a very overrated actor.
Have we talked about this before?
I don't think we have.
This is what I think the problem is with Daniel Day-Lewis's performances. They're so amazing that they put in stark contrast his performance and the rest of the cast. Mm-hmm. And so whether or not he is doing something spectacular, and whether or not it's great, or he's enveloping himself so much in these characters that it just like shines a spotlight on all the other actors, I think. So like in Lincoln, he is doing something, I think, like incredible. Just the way that he is performing is a spectacle. Mm-hmm. But then you're just like, oh, there's Abraham Lincoln and Sally Fields.
Right. You know, but, I mean, the thing is, you know, like, when you have a performance like that, that's called scenery chewing. And it's not fair to the other actors in the scene. And I think like, his style, that method acting style, is so outmoded and outdated. And I think his mode, he can do fantastic impressions. And, like, the idea that he can embody Abraham Lincoln, I think, is absolutely absurd. I think he does a good job. But I think what a true test for a great actor is whether you can do comedy. And I don't think Daniel Day-Lewis will ever be able to pull off a comedic role, because I don't think he has that kind of timing. I think it's a showcase. His movies are just a showcase for him to, like, grimace a lot and have a lot of tics. I mean, I think he's so overrated as an actor. And the thing is, like, he I think he makes some good choices as an actor. Like, I think, yes, work with Paul Thomas Anderson. Wonderful. I mean, I think There Will Be Blood is a great movie.
See, well, I was going to say, bring that up. I don't think that's a great movie, and I almost thought that it was very odd when I was watching it. I felt like, oh, sorry, buddy, you wasted a good performance on a bad movie.
Wow, so that's one of your overrated ones then, right?
I guess I hadn't thought about that one. Yeah. But, you know, I just think that, like his characters, I think, are really compelling, but I don't know. Maybe I'm approaching it in a slightly different way, but I'm always thinking, look, dude, tone it down a little bit, you know, and be more of a team player. Mm-hmm. You know, like, people often, like, complain about star athletes. So they're like, yeah, he's great, but does he make his teammates better? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and I almost feel like that should be a consideration. It's like, yeah,
no, that's a part of good acting. That's definitely part of it. Yeah,
that you're making it, like, you know, like I said, then it just looks like Abraham Lincoln and Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
I really haven't seen too many Daniel Day-Lewis movies, but I mean, so Gangs of New York, he's entertaining.
I actually think he is good in that one.
I'm not sure. Is it easier to play, like, the outrageous, charismatic villain?
Cause yes.
So
that one, maybe it's just easy to pull off when you're just...
Yes, I mean, it's fun for an actor to get to, as I say, chew the scenery. You get to make the scene yours. You get to, like, be as flamboyant as your heart desires. And I think it's a great opportunity for an actor.
Right.
And he sinks his teeth into it. And there's a sense of fun to that one.
Right.
Which is missing from most of his performances. To me, he's such a dull actor in many ways. I don't know.
I would say, like, I'm seeing, like, a lot of your issues. Yeah. I understand a lot of your issues, and I'm sympathetic with them, but I don't think I would use the term dull.
All right, dull is unfair.
Yeah.
That might be unfair. I'm saying inflammatory things to get a rise out of people. I don't actually think he's that dull.
I'm inflamed.
You should see him. When you go into a movie, do you take the word of, like, what gets you more excited, the word of critics or the word of, like, of your friends?
It's generally friends. And then, of course, all of your friends are kind of on their own metric, you know?
Yeah.
You're like, oh, well, so-and-so said this is going to be good. Yeah, but so-and-so said that was going to be good.
Right.
You know? And then I guess you can do the similar thing with critics. Like, you might say, like, oh, well, Ebert likes this. And I generally like what Ebert likes.
Yeah.
You know? So it's kind of all over the spectrum.
So, but how do you gauge whether something is getting hyped? I mean, are you aware of hype surrounding certain movies?
I think so. Just, you know, in their rollout, like, are you hearing a lot about it? And I think oftentimes it will be influenced just by the ad campaign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Gary, how about you?
Pauline, my guidance is solely taken from the experts at FlixWise.
Yes.
A given.
Yeah. That is the correct answer. Thank you,
the trouble is, I can only go one movie a week.
I know.
Sometimes not even that.
Sometimes we take detours and other things.
Slow and steady wins the race.
That's right.
You only need one movie a week, you know?
Yeah. So, to be honest, I do listen to my sister as one of my sources. But in general, I usually listen to critics more than so I don't go to the theaters that often. I usually, the time I'll start going to the theaters is around Oscar season when those movies come out. I generally wait for those big summer action things to get to video before I watch those. And I don't know. In general, I find my friends are not on the same wavelength as me. Though I don't
know.
They
are or they aren't.
Usually not so much. They have different dates. But this is a separate topic. But I'm generally a fairly charitable viewer.
Okay.
Or I have a bell curve in the distribution of quality of movies. So most things are average. The average thing is average.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I guess. Yeah. I guess that makes it. Gabe, are you someone who is inclined to like things, or are you generally more negative?
I think
more critical.
Yeah, that's like the word I would use. I'm not like a Debbie Downer, mm-hmm. but I tend to be very critical of the films. But in the sense, but I enjoy that, you know. So so like I will see, you know, most anything. You know, I'll go see it.
Mm-hmm.
But a large part of my enjoyment of films is being very critical of them.
Okay,
So it'll take a lot for me to say that is a great movie, but I enjoy things and I'll be open-minded about it, you know, but I am very critical.
Yeah, I think I'm sort of on the same wavelength. So, but that just means you can take it from us. You can believe us when we say that something is overrated
exactly.
or something is not as good as people say. So, it pays to have discerning taste.
Indeed.
Try and offset the inevitable flood of hate mail that our last segment surely provoked. Let's end this thing with a few final notes of positivity. Gabe, what's one piece of culture that you don't think is overrated? Or perhaps something that you'd like to bring more attention to?
What I would like to bring attention to is the work of a friend of mine, Phil Holland, and the work that he's doing recently with his Red Dragon Epic camera.
Okay.
And over the recently, there were huge, like historically large waves down in Newport Beach. And he went down with his big camera and shot some video of them. And it is spectacular.
All right. Well, we'll have to link that on our website. Gary, how about you? What's one thing that's that you've been digging lately?
Something positive?
Something positive.
Protons.
Protons. go on. That's it?
I mean, I don't know what else needs to be said, Pauline.
You
linked to that Wikipedia page.
Crying out loud.
Also, word up for chocolate malts.
Chocolate malts? That's not exactly cultural, but
I feel like it is. People aren't getting malt. I feel like my whole generation, people are just going with the straight milkshake. Go with the malt.
All right. Well, Garrett, perhaps this can be a note of positivity. Is there a certain deli or a certain establishment where one could possibly pick up a very delicious malt?
Yeah. So yesterday I got myself a delicious chocolate malt at Langer's Delicatessen, where right near MacArthur's Park, where you will find cakes melting galore. It was delicious. So shout out to Langer's Deli, also excellent pastrami.
All right. I like it. I actually had some trouble coming up with a note of positivity this week. Sort of a downer of a week for me, I guess. But I'm very positive about my brother coming to this podcast and being in Los Angeles, making an appearance. I initially was gonna talk about The Sopranos because it seemed to tie in very nicely with the Godfather segment, but I watched an episode this morning that was really, really disturbing, and now I don't feel like I can endorse it wholeheartedly. But I will just say the episode was Employee of the Month, And those of you who have seen the series know which episode that is. Or instead of giving a shout out to the entire length of the show, which is a great, it's a great show, obviously very important in television history. I kind of feel the way about I sort of feel the same way about that show as I feel about The Godfather. But Lorraine Bracco in this episode is pretty devastating, and she probably gives the best line reading of the word no in all of cinema history. So, Wow. Yeah, if that doesn't get you to watch, then...
What about Billy in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
Well, this one's a little bit more subtle.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this is it's a very, very devastating... Not devastating, but just... I guess it's sort of a triumphant no. Sort of a triumphant no. It's very, very ambiguous. But she's obviously a very talented actress. We've mentioned the Goodfellas on the show. Lorraine Bracco is my final note of positivity. And that's the way we frame it. Flixwise, that is. What are some examples of movies that you think are overrated? Come tell us on our website, flixwise.com. You can also leave us a comment on Facebook, facebook.com/flixwise. And if you're so over Facebook, not to worry, because we're also on the Twitters. The handle is @flixwise. But before you do any of that, please rate us and leave us a comment on iTunes. On our next show, we're going to talk about another movie that's tied with La Ventura and The Godfather for the 21st spot on the Sight and Sound Critics poll, Jean-Luc Godard's Contempt. Listen up to find out if our panel thinks the sight of a young Mademoiselle Bardot is still as captivating as it was back in 1963 when the film was released. Until then, Gabe, thank you as always.
Leave the gun. Take the cannoli.
Take the cannoli. Gary, thank you so much for joining us. You got any last Godfather impression for us?
You can act like a man.
All right, take care.